He looked at the proud gray standing with his neck arched and with one hoof lightly pawing the earth, and was suddenly overcome with gratitude. He clasped the Malorian Emperor's hand warmly. "This is a magnificent gift, Zakath."
"Of course it is. I am a magnificent fellow. Or hadn't you noticed? Ride him, Geryon. Feel the wind in your face, and let the thunder of his hooves fill your blood."
"Well," Geryon said, trying to control his eagerness, "maybe he and I really ought to get to know each other."
Zakath laughed with delight. "Of course," he said.
Geryon approached the big gray horse, who watched him quite calmly. "I guess we'll be sharing a saddle for a while," he said to the animal.
Kutsien nickered and nudged at Geryon with his nose.
"He wants to run," Eriand said. "I'll ride with you if you don't mind. Horse wants to run, too."
"All right," Geryon agreed. "Let's go, then." He gathered the reins, set his foot in the stirrup, and swung up into the saddle. The gray was running almost before Geryon was in place. It was a new experience. Geryon had spent many hours riding, sometimes for weeks on end. He had always taken care of his mounts, as any good Sindar would, but there had never really been any personal attachment before. For him, a horse had simply been a means of conveyance, a way to get from one place to another, and riding had never been a particular source of pleasure. With this great stallion, Kretien, however, it was altogether different. There was a kind of electric thrill to the feel of the big horse's muscles bunching and flowing beneath him. They ran out across the winter-browned grass toward a rounded hill a mile or so distant, with Eriand and his chestnut stallion racing alongside. When they reached the hilltop, Geryon was breathless and laughing with sheer delight. He reined in, and Kretien reared, pawing at the air with his hooves, wanting to be off again.
"Now you know, don't you?"
Eriand asked with a broad smile.
"Yes," Geryon admitted, still laughing. "I guess I do. I wonder how I missed it all these years."
"You have to have the right horse," Eriand told him wisely.
He gave Geryon a sidelong glance.
"You know, you'll never be the same again, don't you?"
"That's all right," Geryon replied.
"I was getting tired of the old way anyhow."
He pointed at a low string of hills outlined against the crisp blue sky, a league or so on ahead.
"Why don't we go over there and see what's on the other side?"
"Why not?"
Geryon laughed. And so they did. The Emperor's household staff was well organized, and a goodly number of them rode on ahead to prepare their night's encampment at a spot almost precisely halfway to the coast. The column started early the following morning, riding again along a frosty track beneath a deep blue sky. It was late afternoon when they crested a hill to look out over the expanse of the Sea of the East, rolling a dark blue under the winter sun, and with smoky-looking cloud banks the color of rust blurring the far horizon. 2 dozen ships, with their red sails furled, stood at anchor in the indented curve of a shallow bay far below, and Geryon looked with some puzzlement at Zakath.
"Another symptom of the vulgar ostentation I mentioned," the Emperor shrugged. "I ordered this fleet down here from the port at Ktan. A dozen or so of those ships are here to transport all of my hangers-on and toadies, as well as the humbler people who actually do the work. The other dozen are here to escort our royal personages with suitable pomp. You have to have pomp, Geryon. Otherwise people might mistake a king or an emperor for an honest man."
"You're in a whimsical humor this afternoon."
"Maybe it is another of those lingering symptoms Dissel mentioned. We will sleep on board ship tonight, and sail at first light tomorrow."
Geryon nodded, touching Kretien's bowed neck with an odd kind of regret as he handed his reins to a waiting groom. The vessel to which they were ferried from the sandy beach was opulent. Unlike the cramped cabins on most of the other ships Geryon had sailed aboard, the chambers on this one were nearly as large as the rooms in a fair-sized house. It took him a little while to pin down the reason for the difference. The other ships had devoted so little room to cabins because the bulk of the space on board had been devoted to cargo. The only cargo this ship customarily carried, however, was the Emperor of Meloria. They dined that evening on lobster, served in the low-beamed dining room aboard Zakath's floating palace. So much of Geryon's attention for the past week or more had been fixed on the unpredictable Emperor that he had not had much opportunity to talk with his friends. Thus, when they took their places at the table, he rather deliberately sat at the opposite end from the Melorian. It was with a great deal of relief that he took his seat between Polgara and Durnik, while Zenedra and Velvet diverted the Emperor with sparkling feminine chatter.
"You look tired, Geryon," Polgara noted. "I have been under a certain strain," he replied. "I wish that man would not keep changing every other minute. Every time I think I've got him figured out, he turns into somebody else." "It's not a good idea to categorize people, dear," she advised placidly, touching his arm. "That is the first sign of fuzzy thinking."
"Are we actually supposed to eat these things?" Durnik asked in a disgusted sort of voice, pointing his knife at the bright red lobster staring up at him from his plate, with its claws seemingly at the ready.
"That's what the pliers are here for, Durnik,"
Polgara explained in a peculiarly mild tone.
"You have to crack it out of its shell."
He pushed his plate away.
"I'm not going to eat something that looks like a big red bug," he declared with uncharacteristic heat. "I draw the line at some things."
"Lobster is a delicacy, Durnik," he grunted.
"Some people eat snails, too."
Her eyes flashed, but then she gained control of her anger and continued to speak to him in that same mild tone.
"I am sure we can have them take it away and bring you something else."
He glared at her. Geryon looked back and forth between the two of them. Then he decided that they had all known each other for far too long to step delicately around any problems.
"What's the matter, Durnik?" he asked bluntly. "You're as cross as a badger with a sore nose."
"Nothing," Durnik almost snapped at him.
Geryon began to put a few things together. He remembered the plea Andel had made to Aunt Paul concerning Toth. He looked down the table to where the big mute, his eyes lowered to his plate, seemed almost to be trying to make himself invisible. Then he looked back at Durnik, who kept his face stiffly turned away from his former friend.
"Oh," he said, "now I think I understand. Aunt Paul told you something you did not want to hear. Someone you liked very much did something that made you angry. You said some things to him that you wish now you hadn't said. Then you found out that he didn't really have any choice in the matter, and that what he did was really right after all. Now you would like to make friends with him again, but you don't know how. Is that sort of why you're behaving this way, and being so impolite to Aunt Paul?"
Durnik's look was at first stricken, then his face grew red, then pale.
"I don't have to listen to this,"
he burst out, coming to his feet.
"Oh, sit down, Durnik," Geryon told him. "We all love each other too much to behave this way. Instead of being embarrassed and bad-tempered about it, why don't we see what we can do to fix it?"
Durnik tried to meet Geryon's eyes, but finally lowered his head, his face flaming.
"I treated him badly, Geryon," he mumbled,
sinking back into his chair again.
"Yes," Geryon agreed. "You did. But it was because you did not understand what he was doing and why. I didn't understand myself until the day before yesterday, when Zakath finally changed his mind and decided to take us all to Malzeth. Ceratus knew that he was going to do that. And that's why she made Toth turn us over to Ataska's men. She wants us to get to the Sardian and meet Zandramas. And so she's going to arrange it. Toth will be the one who does what she thinks has to be done to accomplish that. Under the present circumstances, we couldn't find a better friend.
How can I possibly, I mean, after the way I treated him?
Be honest. Admit that you were wrong, and apologize.
Dernick's face grew stiff.
It doesn't have to be in words, Dernick, Garion told his friend patiently. You and Toth have been talking together without words for months.
He looked speculatively up at the low-beamed ceiling.
This is a ship, he noted, and we are going out onto an ocean. Do you imagine that there might be a few fish out there in all of that water?
Dernick's smile was immediate. Polgara's sigh, however, was pensive. The smith looked almost shyly across the table.
How did you say that I'm supposed to get this bug out of its shell, Paul?
He asked, pointing at the angry-looking lobster on his plate. They sailed northeasterly from the coast of Haga, and soon left winter behind. At some point during the voyage, they crossed that imaginary line equidistant from the poles, and once again entered the northern half of the world. Dernick and Toth, shyly at first, but then with growing confidence, resumed their friendship and spent their days at the ship's stern, probing the sea with lines, bright-colored lures, and various baits gleaned from the galley. Sakath's humor continued to remain uncharacteristically sunny, though his discussions with Belgarath and Polgara centered on the nature of demons, a subject about which there was very little to smile. Finally, one day, when they had been at sea for about a week, a servant came up to Garion, who stood at the portside rail watching the dance of the wind atop the sparkling waves, and advised him that the Emperor would like to see him. Garion nodded and made his way aft to the cabin where Zakath customarily held audience. Like most of the cabins aboard this floating palace, this one was quite large and ostentatiously decorated. Owing to the broad windows stretching across the ship's stern, the room was bright and airy. The drapes at the sides of the windows were of crimson velvet, and the fine Malorian carpet was a deep blue. Sakath, dressed as always in plain white linen, sat on a low, leather-upholstered divan at the far end of the cabin. Looking out at the white caps and the flock of snowy gulls trailing his ship, his cat lay purring in his lap as he absently stroked her ears.
"You wanted to see me, Zakath?" Garion asked as he entered.
"Yes. Come in, Garion," the Malorian replied. "I have not seen much of you for the past few days. Are you cross with me?"
"No," Garion said. "You've been busy learning about demons. I don't know that much about them, so I couldn't have added all that much to the discussion."
He crossed the cabin, pausing at one point, to stoop and unwrap a ferociously playful kitten from around his left ankle.
"They love to pounce," Zakath smiled.
A thought came to Garion, and he looked around warily.
"Zith isn't in here, is she?"
Zakath laughed. "No. Sadi has devised a means of keeping her at home."
He looked whimsically at Garion.
"Is she really as deadly as he says?"
Garion nodded.
"She bit a Grolem at Rak Urga. He was dead in about a half a minute."
Zakath shuddered.
"You don't have to tell Sadi about this. But snakes make my flesh creep."
"Talk to Silk. He can give you a whole dissertation about how much he dislikes them."
"He is a complicated little fellow, isn't he?"
Garion smiled.
"Oh, yes. His life is filled with danger and excitement. And so his nerves are as tightly wound as lute strings. He's erratic sometimes, but you get used to that after a while."
He looked at the other man critically.
"You're looking particularly fit," he noted, sitting down on the other end of the leather couch. "Sea air must agree with you."
"I don't think it's really the air, Garion. I think it has to do with the fact that I have been sleeping 8 to 10 hours a night.
Sleep? You?
Astonishing, isn't it?
Zakath's face went suddenly quite somber.
I would rather that this did not go any further, Garion.
Of course.
Urgot told you what happened when I was young?
Garion nodded.
Yes.
My habit of not sleeping very much dates from then. A face that had been particularly dear to me haunted my dreams, and sleep became an agony to me.
That didn't diminish? Not even after some 30 years?
Not one bit. I lived in continual grief and guilt and remorse. I lived only to revenge myself on Tar Urgas. Kohag's saber robbed me of that. I had planned 12 different deaths for the madman, each more horrible than the one before. But he cheated me by dying cleanly in battle.
No,
Garion disagreed. His death was worse than anything you could have possibly devised. I have talked with Kohag about it. Tar Urgas went totally mad before Kohag killed him, but he lived long enough to realize that he had finally been beaten. He died biting and clawing at the earth in frustration. Being beaten was more than he could bear.
Zakath thought about it.
Yes, he said finally. That would have been quite dreadful for him, wouldn't it? I think that maybe I am less disappointed now.
And was it your discovery that the Urga line is now extinct that finally laid the ghost that has haunted your sleep all these years to rest?
No, Garion. I don't think that had anything to do with it. It is just that instead of the face that had always been there before, now I see a different face.
Oh?
A blindfolded face.
Saradis? I don't know that I'd recommend thinking about her in that fashion.
You misunderstand, Garion. She's hardly more than a child, but somehow she has touched my life with more peace and comfort than I have ever known. I sleep like a baby, and I walk around all day with this silly euphoria bubbling up in me. Frankly, I cannot stand myself like this, but I can't help it for some reason.
Garion stared out the window, not even seeing the play of sunlight on the waves, nor the hovering gulls. And then it came to him so clearly that he knew that it was undeniably true.
It's because you've come to that crossroads in your life that Saradis mentioned. You are being rewarded because you have chosen the right fork.
Rewarded?
By whom?
Garion looked at him and suddenly laughed.
I don't think you are quite ready to accept that information yet. Could you bring yourself to believe that it's Saradis who is making you feel good right now?
In some vague way, yes.
It goes a little deeper, but that's a start.
Garion looked at the slightly perplexed man in front of him.
You and I are caught up together in something over which we have absolutely no control. I've been through it before, so I will try to cushion the shocks that are in store for you as much as I can. Just try to keep an open mind about a peculiar way of looking at the world.
He thought about it some more.
I think that we are going to be working together, at least up to a point, so we might as well be friends.
He held out his right hand.
Zakath laughed. Why not?
He said, taking Garion's hand in a firm grip.
I think we are both as crazy as Tar Urgas, but why not? We are the two most powerful men in the world. We should be deadly enemies, and you propose friendship. Well, why not?
He laughed again delightedly.
We have much more deadly enemies, Zakath.
Garion said gravely.
And all of your armies, and all of mine. won't mean a thing when we get to where we are going.
And where is that, my young friend?
I think it's called The Place Which Is No More.
I have been meaning to ask you about that. The whole phrase is a contradiction in terms. How can you go someplace which does not exist anymore?
I don't really know. I'll tell you, though, when we get there.
2 days later, they arrived at Mal Gamila, a port in southern Meloria, Antiqua, and took to horse. They rode eastward at a canter on a well-maintained highway that crossed a pleasant plain green with spring. A regiment of red-tuniced cavalrymen cleared the road ahead of them, and their pace left the entourage which usually accompanied the emperor far behind. There were way stations along the highway, not unlike the Tolnedran hostels dotting the roads in the west, and the imperial guard rather brusquely ejected other guests at these roadside stops to make way for the emperor and his party. As they pressed onward day after day, Geryon began slowly to comprehend the true significance of the word boundless as it was applied to Meloria. The plains of Elgeria, which had always before seemed incredibly vast, shrank into insignificance. The snowy peaks of the Delesian Mountains, lying to the south of the road they traveled, raked their white talons at the sky. Geryon drew in on himself, feeling smaller and smaller the deeper they rode into this vast domain. Peculiarly, Zinedra seemed to be suffering a similar shrinkage, and she quite obviously did not like it very much. Her comments became increasingly waspish, her observations more acid. She found the loose-fitting garments of the peasantry uncouth. She found fault with the construction of the gang-plows that opened whole acres at a time behind patiently plodding herds of oxen. She didn't like the food, even the water, as clear as crystal and as cold and sweet as might have sprung from any crevice in the Tolnedran Mountains, offended her taste. Silk, his eyes alight with mischief, rode at her side on the sunny mid-morning of the last day of their journey from Mal Gamila. "Oh, beware, your Majesty," he warned her slyly, as they neared the crest of a hillside sheathed in pale spring grass, so verdant that it almost looked like a filmy green mist. "The first sight of Malzeth has sometimes struck the unwary traveller blind. To be safe, why don't you cover one eye with your hand? That way you can preserve at least partial sight." Her face grew frosty, and she drew herself to her full height in her saddle, a move that might have come off better had she been only slightly taller, and said to him in her most imperious tone,
"We are not amused, Prince Kaldar, and we do not expect to find a barbarian city at the far end of the world, a rival to the splendors of Tolhanath, the only truly imperial city in the..."
And then she stopped, as they all did. The valley beyond the crest stretched not for miles, but for leagues, and it was filled to overflowing with the city of Malzeth. The streets were as straight as tautly stretched strings, and the buildings gleamed, not with marble, for there was not marble enough in all of the world to sheath the buildings of this enormous city, but rather with an intensely gleaming thick white mortar that seemed somehow to shoot light at the eye. It was stupendous.
"It's not much," Zakath said in an exaggeratedly deprecating tone. "Just a friendly little place that we like to call home."
He looked at Zinedra's stiff, pale little face with an artful expression.
"We really should press on, your Majesty," he told her. "It is a half-day's ride to the Imperial Palace from here."
Part 2. Malzeth. Chapter 6. The gates of Malzeth, like those of Tolhanath, were of bronze, broad and burnished. The city lying within those gates, however, was significantly different from the capital of the Tolnedran Empire. There was a peculiar sameness about the structures, and they were built so tightly against each other that the broad avenues of the city were lined on either side by solid mortar-covered walls, pierced only by deeply inset arched doorways with narrow white stairways leading up to the flat rooftops. Here and there, the mortar had crumbled away, revealing the fact that the buildings beneath that coating were constructed of squared-off timbers. Durnick, who believed that all buildings should be built of stone, noted that fact with a look of disapproval. As they moved deeper into the city, Garion noticed the almost total lack of windows.
"I don't want to seem critical," he said to Zakath, "but isn't your city just a little monotonous?"
Zakath looked at him curiously.
"All the houses are the same, and there aren't very many windows."
"Oh," Zakath smiled. "That is one of the drawbacks of leaving architecture up to the military. They are great believers in uniformity, and windows have no place in military fortifications. Each house has its own little garden, though, and the windows face that. In the summertime, the people spend most of their time in their gardens, or on the rooftops."
"Is the whole city like this?"
Durnick asked, looking at the cramped little houses all packed together.
"No, Goodman," the Emperor replied. "This quarter of the city was built for corporals. The streets reserved for officers are a bit more ornate, and those where the privates and workmen live are much shabbier. Military people tend to be very conscious of rank, and the appearances that go with it."
A few doors down a side street, branching off from the one they followed, a stout, red-faced woman was shrilly berating a scrawny-looking fellow with a hangdog expression as a group of soldiers removed furniture from a house and piled it on a rickety cart.
"You had to go do it, didn't you, Actus?"
she demanded.
"You had to go get drunk and insult your captain. Now what is to become of us? I spent all those years living in those pigsty private quarters, waiting for you to get promoted. Just when I think things are taking a turn for the better, you have to destroy it all by getting drunk and being reduced to a private again."
He mumbled something.
"What was that?"
"Nothing, dear."
"I'm not going to let you forget this, Actus. Let me tell you."
"Life does have its little ups and downs, doesn't it?"
Tzadi murmured as they rode on out of earshot.
"I don't think it's anything to laugh about,"
Tzinedra said with surprising heat.
"They are being thrown out of their home over a moment's foolishness. Can't someone do something?"
Zakath gave her an appraising look, then beckoned to one of the red-cloaked officers riding respectfully along behind them.
"Find out which unit that man is in," he instructed. "Then go to his captain and tell him that I would take it as a personal favor if Actus were reinstated in his former rank, on the condition that he stays sober." "At once, Your Majesty,"
the officer saluted and rode off.
"Why, thank you, Zakath,"
Tzinedra said, sounding a little startled.
"My pleasure, Tzinedra."
He bowed to her from his saddle, then laughed shortly.
"I suspect that Actus's wife will see to it that he suffers sufficiently for his misdeeds anyway.
Aren't you afraid that such acts of compassion might damage your reputation, Your Majesty?"
Tzadi asked him.
"No," Zakath replied. "A ruler must always strive to be unpredictable, Tzadi. It keeps the underlings off balance. Besides, an occasional act of charity toward the lower ranks helps to strengthen their loyalty."
"Don't you ever do anything that is not motivated by politics?" Garion asked him.
For some reason, Zakath's flippant explanation of his act irritated him.
"Not that I can think of," Zakath said. "Politics is the greatest game in the world, Garion,
But you have to play it all of the time to keep your edge.
Silk laughed. I have said the exact same thing about commerce. About the only difference I can see is that in commerce you have money as a way of keeping score. How do you keep score in politics?
Zakath's expression was peculiarly mixed, half amused and half deadly serious.
It's very simple, Keldar. If you are still on the throne at the end of the day, you have won. If you are dead, you have lost. And each day is a complete new game.
Silk gave him a long, speculative look, then looked over at Geryon, his fingers moving slightly. I need to talk to you at once. Geryon nodded briefly, then leaned over in his saddle and reined in.
Something wrong?
Zakath asked him. I think my cinch is loose, Geryon replied, dismounting. Go on ahead. I'll catch up.
Here, I'll help you, Geryon,
Silk offered, also swinging down from his saddle.
What's this all about?
Geryon asked when the Emperor, chatting with Tenedra and Velvet, had ridden out of earshot.
Oh, be very careful with him, Geryon,
the little man replied quietly, pretending to check the straps on Geryon's saddle.
He let something slip there. Oh, he's all smiles and courtesy on the surface. But underneath it all, he hasn't really changed all that much.
Wasn't he just joking?
Not even a little. He was deadly serious. He's brought us all to Malazeth for reasons that have nothing to do with Menga or our search for Zandramos. Be on your guard with him. That friendly smile of his can fall off of his face without any warning at all.
He spoke a little more loudly then.
There, he said, tugging at a strap. That ought to hold it. Let's catch up with the others.
They rode into a broad square, surrounded on all sides by canvas booths dyed in various hues of red, green, blue, and yellow. The square teemed with merchants and citizens, all dressed in varicolored loose-fitting robes that hung to their heels.
Where do the common citizens live if the whole city's divided up into sections based on military rank?
Durnick asked. Brador, the bald, chubby chief of the Bureau of Internal Affairs, who happened to be riding beside the smith, looked around with a smile.
They all have their ranks, good man, he replied.
Each according to his individual accomplishments. It's all very rigidly controlled by the Bureau of Promotions. Housing, places of business, suitable marriages. They're all determined by rank.
Isn't that sort of over-regimented?
Durnick asked pointedly.
Valorians love to be regimented, Goodman Durnick, Brador laughed. Angoraks bow automatically to authority. Melusines have a deep inner need to compartmentalize things. Karans are too stupid to take control of their own destinies. And the Dowls? Well, nobody knows what the Dowls want.
We aren't really all that different from the people in the West, Durnick,
Zakath said, back over his shoulder.
In Tulnedra and Sindaria, such matters are determined by economics. People gravitate to the houses and shops and marriages that they can afford. We have just formalized it, that is all.
Tell me, Your Majesty, Zadi said, how is it that your people are so undemonstrative?
I don't quite follow you.
Shouldn't they at least salute as you ride by? You are the Emperor, after all.
They do not recognize me,
Zakath shrugged.
The Emperor is a man in crimson robes who rides in a golden carriage, wears a terribly heavy jeweled crown, and is accompanied by at least a regiment of Imperial Guards, all blowing trumpets. I am just a man in a white linen, riding through town with a few friends.
Geryon thought about that,
still mindful of Silk's half-whispered warning. The almost total lack of any kind of self-aggrandizement implicit in Zakath's statement revealed yet another facet of the man's complex personality. He was quite sure that not even King Fulrak of Sindaria, the most modest of all the monarchs of the West, could be quite so self-effacing. The streets beyond the square were lined with somewhat larger houses than those they had passed near the city gates, and there had been some attempt at ornamentation here. It appeared, however, that Malorian sculptors had limited talent, and the mortar-cast filigree surmounting the front of each house was heavy and graceless.
"The sergeant's district," Zakath said laconically.
The city seemed to go on forever. At regular intervals, there were squares and marketplaces and bazaars, all filled with people wearing the bright, loose-fitting robes that appeared to be the standard Malorian garb. When they passed the last of the rigidly similar houses of the sergeants, and of those civilians of equal rank, they entered a broad belt of trees and lawns where fountains splashed and sparkled in the sunlight, and where broad promenades were lined with carefully sculptured green hedges interspersed with cherry trees, laden with pink blossoms all shimmering in the light breeze.
"How lovely!"
Zinedra exclaimed.
"We do have some beauty here in Malzeth," Zakath told her. "No one, not even an army architect, could make a city this big uniformly ugly."
"The officers' districts aren't quite so severe," Silk told the little queen.
"You are familiar with Malzeth, then, your highness?"
Braedor asked. Silk nodded. "My partner and I have a facility here," he replied. "It's more in the nature of a centralized collection point than an actual business. It is cumbersome doing business in Malzeth. Too many regulations."
"Might one inquire as to the rank you were assigned?"
the moon-faced bureaucrat asked delicately. "We are generals," Silk said in a rather grand offhand manner. "Yarblek wanted to be a field marshal, but I don't think the expense of buying that much rank is really justified."
"Is rank for sale?"
Zadi asked.
"In Malzeth, everything is for sale," Silk replied. "In most respects, it's almost exactly like Tol Hanath."
"Not entirely, Silk,"
Zinedra said primly.
"Only in the broadest terms, Your Imperial Highness," he agreed quickly. "Malzeth has never been graced by the presence of a divinely beautiful imperial princess, glowing like a precious jewel and shooting beams of her fire back at the sun."
She gave him a hard look, then turned her back on him.
"What did I say?"
the little man asked Geryon, in an injured tone.
"People always suspect you, Silk," Geryon told him. "They can never quite be sure that you're not making fun of them. I thought you knew that."
Silk sighed tragically.
"Nobody understands me," he complained.
"Oh, I think they do." The plazas and boulevards beyond the belt of parks and gardens were more grand, and the houses larger, setting apart from each other. There was still, however, a stiff similarity about them, a kind of stern sameness that ensured that men of equal rank would be assigned to rigidly equal quarters. Another broad strip of lawns and trees lay beyond the mansions of the generals, and their mercantile equivalents, and within that encircling green, there arose a fair-sized marble city with its own walls and burnished gates.
"The Imperial Palace," Zakath said indifferently.
He frowned.
"What have you done over there?"
he asked Braedor, pointing at a long row of tall buildings rising near the south wall of the enclosed compound. Braedor coughed delicately.
"Those are the bureaucratic offices, Your Majesty," he replied in neutral tones. "You will recall that you authorized their construction just before the Battle of Tol Mardu."
Zakath pursed his lips.
"I had not expected something on quite such a grand scale." "There are quite a lot of us, Your Majesty, Braydor explained. And we felt that things might be more harmonious if each bureau had its own building.
He looked a bit apologetic.
We really did need the space, he explained defensively to Tzadi. We were all jumbled together with the military, and very often men from different bureaus had to share the same office. It's really much more efficient this way, wouldn't you say?
I think I would prefer it, if you didn't involve me in this discussion, Your Excellency, Tzadi answered.
I was merely attempting to draw upon Your Excellency's expertise in managing affairs of state.
Salmisra's palace is somewhat unique, Tzadi told him. We like being jumbled together. It gives us more opportunities for spying and murder and intrigue and the other normal functions of government.
As they approached the gates to the imperial complex, Geryon noticed with some surprise that the thick bronze gates had been overlaid with beaten gold, and his thrifty Sindarian heritage recoiled from the thought of such wanton lavishness. Tzinedra, however, looked at the priceless gates with undisguised acquisitiveness. You wouldn't be able to move them, Silk advised her.
What?
She said inattentively. The gates, they are much too heavy to steal.
Shut up, Silk,
she said absently, her eyes still appraising the gates. He began to laugh uproariously, and she looked at him, her green eyes narrowing dangerously.
I think I'll ride back to see what's keeping Belgarath, the little man said.
Do,
she said. Then she looked at Geryon, who was trying to conceal a broad grin.
Something funny?
No, dear, he replied quickly. Just enjoying the scenery, that's all. The detachment of guards at the gates was neither as burnished nor plumed as the ceremonial guards at the gates of Tolhanath. They wore polished shirts of chainmail over the customary red tunic, baggy breeches tucked into the tops of knee-high boots, red cloaks, and pointed conical helmets. They nonetheless looked very much like soldiers. They greeted Khalzakath with crisp military salutes, and as the Emperor passed through the gilded gates, trumpeteers announced his entrance into the imperial compound with a brazen fanfare.
I have always hated that, the Malorian ruler said confidentially to Geryon. That sound grates on my ears.
What irritated me were the people who used to follow me around hoping that I might need something, Geryon told him.
That is convenient sometimes.
Geryon nodded. Sometimes. But it stopped being convenient when one of them threw a knife at my back.
Really? I thought your people universally adored you.
It was a misunderstanding. The young man and I had a talk about it, and he promised not to do it anymore.
That is all? Zakath exclaimed with astonishment. You did not have him executed?
Of course not. Once he and I understood each other, he turned out to be extraordinarily loyal. He was killed at Tul Mardu,
Geryon sighed sadly. I am sorry, Geryon, Zakath said. We all lost friends at Tul Mardu.
The marble-clad buildings inside the imperial complex were a jumble of conflicting architectural styles, ranging from the severely utilitarian to the elaborately ornate. For some reason, Geryon was reminded of the vast rabbit warren of King Anheg's palace at Val Alorn. Although Zakath's palace did not consist of one single building, the structures were all linked to each other by column-lined promenades and galleries, which passed through park-like grounds studded with statues and marble pavilions. Zakath led them through the confusing maze toward the middle of the complex, where a single palace stood in splendid isolation, announcing by its expanse and height that it was the center of all power in boundless Meloria.
The residence of Kalath the Unifier, the Emperor announced with grand irony. My revered ancestor.
Isn't it just a bit overdone?
Sinedra asked tartly, still obviously unwilling to concede the fact that Malzeth far outstripped her girlhood home.
Of course it is, the Malorian replied. But the ostentation was necessary. Karath had to demonstrate to the other generals that he outranked them, and in Malzeth, one's rank is reflected by the size of one's residence. Karath was an undisguised knave, a usurper, and a man of little personal charm. So he had to assert himself in other ways.
Don't you just love politics? Velvet said to Sinedra. It is the only field where the ego is allowed unrestricted play, as long as the treasury holds out.
Zakath laughed.
I should offer you a position in the government, Margravine Lascelles. I think we need an imperial deflator, someone to puncture all our puffed-up self-importance.
Why, thank you, Your Majesty,
she said with a dimpled smile.
If it were not for my commitments to the family business, I might even consider accepting such a post. It sounds like so much fun.
He sighed with mock regret.
Where were you when I needed a wife?
Probably in my cradle, Your Majesty,
she replied innocently. He winced.
That was unkind, he accused.
Yes,
she agreed.
True, though,
she added clinically. He laughed again and looked at Polgara.
I am going to steal her from you, my lady, he declared.
To be your court jester, Kalzakath?
Lascelles asked, her face no longer lightly amused.
To entertain you with clever insults and banter? Ah, no, I do not think so. There is another side to me that I don't think you'd like very much. They call me Velvet, and think of me as a soft-winged butterfly. But this particular butterfly, as a poison sting, as several people have discovered after it was too late.
Behave, dear, Polgara murmured to her, and don't give away trade secrets in a moment of pique.
Yes, Lady Polgara,
she replied meekly. Zakath looked at her, but did not say anything. He swung down from his saddle, and three grooms dashed to his side to take the reins from his hand.
Come along, then, he said to Geryon and the others. I would like to show you around.
He threw a sly glance at Velvet.
I hope that the Margravine would forgive me if I share every homeowner's simple pride in his domicile, no matter how modest.
She laughed a golden little laugh. Geryon dismounted and laid an affectionate hand on Chrétien's proud neck. It was with a pang of almost tangible regret that he handed the reins to a waiting groom. They entered the palace through broad, gilded doors and found themselves in a vaulted rotunda, quite similar in design to the one in the Emperor's palace in Tolhanath, though this one lacked the marble busts that made Varana's entryway appear vaguely like a mausoleum. A crowd of officials, military and civilian, awaited their emperor, each with a sheaf of important-looking documents in his hand. Zakath sighed as he looked at them.
I am afraid we will have to postpone the grand tour. I am certain that you will all want to bathe and change anyway, and perhaps rest a bit before we start the customary formalities. Bredor, would you be good enough to show our guests to their rooms and arrange to have a light lunch prepared for them?
Of course, Your Majesty.
I think the East Wing might be pleasant. It's away from all of the scurrying through the halls in this part of the palace.
My very thought, Your Majesty.
Zakath smiled at them all.
We will dine together this evening. Then he smiled ironically. An intimate little supper with no more than 200 or 300 guests.
He looked at the nervous officials clustered nearby and made a wry face.
Until this evening, then.
Bredor led them through the echoing marble corridors, teeming with servants and minor functionaries.
such a big palace,
Belgarath observed after they had been walking for perhaps 10 minutes. The old man had said very little since they had entered the city, but had ridden in his customary half-doze, although Geryon was quite sure that very little escaped his grandfather's half-closed eyes.
Yes, Brador agreed with him. The first emperor, Kalath, had grandiose notions at times.
Belgarath grunted.
It's a common affliction among rulers.
I think it has something to do with insecurity.
Tell me, Brador, Silk said. Didn't I hear somewhere that the state secret police are under the jurisdiction of your bureau?
Brador nodded with a deprecating little smile.
It is one of my many responsibilities, Prince Keldar, he replied. I need to know what's going on in the Empire in order to stay on top of things. So I had to organize a modest little intelligence service. Nothing on nearly the scale of Queen Porin's, however.
It will grow with time, Velvet assured him. Those things always do, for some reason.
The east wing of the palace was set somewhat apart from the rest of the buildings in the complex, and it embraced a kind of enclosed courtyard or atrium that was green with exotic flowering plants growing about a mirror-like pool at the center. Jewel-like hummingbirds darted from blossom to blossom, adding splashes of vibrant, moving color. Polgara's eyes came alight when Brador opened the door to the suite of rooms she was to share with Dernek. Just beyond an arched doorway, leading from the main sitting room, was a large marble tub sunk into the floor, with little tendrils of steam rising from it.
Oh, my, she sighed. Civilization at last.
Just try not to get waterlogged, Paul, Belgarath said.
Of course not, Father,
she agreed absently, still eyeing the steaming tub with undisguised longing.
Is it really all that important, Paul? He asked her.
Yes, Father, she replied. It really is.
It's an irrational prejudice against dirt.
He grinned at the rest of them.
I've always been sort of fond of dirt myself.
Quite obviously, she said. Then she stopped. Incidentally, old wolf, she said critically, as they all began to file out, if your room happens to be similarly equipped, you should make use of the facilities yourself.
Me?
You smell, Father.
No, Paul, he corrected. I stink. You smell.
Whatever. Go wash, Father. She was already absently removing her shoes.
I have gone as much as 10 years at a time without a bath.
Yes, Father, I know. Only the gods know how well I know. Now, she said in a very businesslike tone, if you will all excuse me, she very deliberately began to unbutton the front of her dress. The suite of rooms to which Geryon and Saenedra were led was, if anything, even more opulent than that shared by Dernek and Polgara. As Geryon moved about the several large chambers, examining the furnishings, Saenedra went directly toward the bath, her eyes dreamy and her clothes falling to the floor behind her as she went. His wife's tendency toward casual nudity had occasionally shocked Geryon in the past. He did not personally object to Saenedra's skin. What disturbed him had been that she had seemed oblivious to the fact that sometimes her unclad state was highly inappropriate. He recalled with a shudder the time when he and the Sindarian ambassador had entered the royal apartment at Riva just as Saenedra was in the process of trying on several new undergarments that she had received from her dressmaker that very morning. Quite calmly, she had asked the ambassador's opinion of various of the frilly little things, modeling each in turn for him. The ambassador, a staid and proper Sindarian gentleman in his 70s, received more shocks in that 10 minutes than he had encountered in the previous half-century, and his next dispatch to King Folarak had plaintively requested that he be relieved of his post. "Saenedra, aren't you at least going to close the door?" Geryon asked her, as she tested the water's temperature with a tentative toe.
"That makes it very hard for us to talk, Garion,"
she replied reasonably, as she stepped down into the tub.
"I hate to have to shout."
"Oh," he said. "I hadn't noticed that."
"Be nice,"
she told him, sinking into the water with a contented sigh. Curiously, she began to unstopper and sniff the crystal decanters lined along one side of the tub. Garion assumed they contained assorted condiments with which ladies seasoned their bath water. Some of these she restoppered disapprovingly. Others she liberally sprinkled into her bath. One or two of them she rubbed on herself in various places.
"What if somebody comes in?"
Garion asked her pointedly.
"Some official or messenger or servant or something."
"Well, what if they do?"
He stared at her.
"Garion, darling,"
she said in that same infuriatingly reasonable tone,
"if they had not intended for the bath to be used, they would not have prepared it, now would they?"
Try as he might, he could not find an answer to that question. She laid her head back into the water, letting her hair fan out around her face. Then she sat up.
"Would you like to wash my back for me?"
she asked him. An hour or so later, after an excellent lunch served by efficient servants, Silk stopped by. The little thief had also bathed and changed clothes once again. His pearl-gray doublet was formally elegant, and he once again dripped jewels. His short, scraggly beard had been neatly trimmed, and there was a faint air of exotic perfume lingering about him. "Appearances," he responded to Garion's quizzical look. "One always wants to put one's best foot forward in a new situation." "Of course," Garion said dryly. "Belgareth asked me to stop by," the little man continued. "There is a large room upstairs. We are gathering there for a council of war."
"War?"
"Metaphorically speaking, of course."
"Oh, of course."
The room at the top of the flight of marble stairs to which Silk led Garion and Saint-Edre was quite large, and there was a throne-like chair on a dais against the back wall. Garion looked about at the lush furnishings and heavy crimson drapes.
"This isn't the throne room, is it?"
"No," Silk replied. "At least not Kalazakath's official one. It's here to make visiting royalty feel at home. Some kings get nervous when they don't have official-looking surroundings to play in."
"Oh."
Belgareth sat with his mismatched boots up on a polished table. His hair and beard were slightly damp, evidence that, despite his pretended indifference to bathing, he had, in fact, followed Polgara's instructions. Polgara and Durnik were talking quietly at one side, and Eriond and Toth were nearby. Velvet and Sadi stood looking out the window at the formal garden lying to the east of Zakath's sprawling palace.
"All right," the old sorcerer said. "I guess we are all here now. I think we need to talk."
"I wouldn't say anything too specific," Silk's fingers said, in the gestures of the Drasnian secret language. "It is almost certain that there are a few spies about." Belgareth looked at the far wall, his eyes narrowed as he searched it inch by inch for hidden peepholes. He grunted and looked at Polgara.
"I'll look into it, father," she murmured.
Her eyes grew distant, and Garion felt the familiar surge. After a moment, she nodded and held up three fingers. She concentrated for a moment, and the quality of the surge changed, seeming somehow languorous. Then she straightened and relaxed her will.
"It's all right now," she told them calmly. "They fell asleep."
"Well, that was very smooth, Paul," Durnik said admiringly.
"Why, thank you, dear,"
she smiled, laying her hand on his. Belgareth put his feet on the floor and leaned forward.
"That's one more thing for us to keep in mind," he said seriously. "We are likely to be watched all the time that we are here in Malzeth. So, be careful. Zakath's a skeptic, so we cannot really be sure just how much of what we have told him he believes.
it is altogether possible that he has other things in mind for us. Right now he needs our help in dealing with Minga. But he still has not entirely abandoned his campaign in Tolmergos. And he might want to use us to bring the Aelorns and the others into that war on his side. He's also got problems with Ervan and Zandramos. We don't have the time to get caught up in internal Malorian politics. At the moment, though, we are more or less in his power. So, let's be careful. Well, we can leave any time we need to, Belgarath, Durnik said confidently. I would rather not do it that way, unless we have absolutely no other choice, the old man replied. Zakath's the kind of man who is very likely to grow testy if he is thwarted, and I don't want to have to creep around dodging his soldiers. It takes too much time, and it's dangerous. I will be a lot happier if we can leave Malzeth with his blessing, or at least with his consent.
I want to get to Ashaba before Zandramas has time to escape again, Geryon insisted.
So do I, Geryon, his grandfather said. But we don't know what she's doing there, so we don't know how long she is likely to stay.
She has been looking for something, father, Polgara told the old man. I saw that in her mind when I trapped her back in Rakhaga.
He looked at her thoughtfully.
Could you get any idea of what it was, Paul?
She shook her head.
Not specifically, she replied. I think it's information of some kind. She cannot go any further until she finds it. I was able to pick that much out of her thoughts.
Whatever it is, has to be well hidden. Belden and I took Ashaba apart after the Battle of Omimbre, and we didn't find anything out of the ordinary. If you can accept the idea that Torak's house was in any way ordinary.
Can we be sure that she's still there with my baby?
Tinidra asked intently. No, dear, Polgra told her. She has taken steps to hide her mind from me. She's rather good, actually.
Even if she has left Ashaba, the orb can pick up her trail again. The chances are pretty good that she has not found what she is looking for, and that effectively nails her down at Ashaba. If she has found it, she won't be hard to follow.
We are going on to Ashaba, then? Sadi asked. What I am getting at is that our concern about Minga was just a ruse to get us to Meloria, wasn't it?
I think I'm going to need more information before I can make any decisions about that. The situation in northern Karanda is serious, certainly. But let's not lose sight of the fact that our primary goal is Zandramos, and she is at Ashaba. Before I can decide anything, though, I need to know more about what's going on here in Meloria.
My department, Silk volunteered.
And mine,
Velvet added.
I might be able to help a bit as well, Zadi noted with a faint smile.
He frowned then.
Seriously, though, Belgarath, you and your family here represent power. I don't think we're going to have much luck at persuading Karl Zakath to let you go willingly, no matter how cordial he may appear on the surface.
The old man nodded glumly. It might turn out that way after all, he agreed. Then he looked at Silk, Velvet, and Zadi.
Be careful, he cautioned them. Don't let your instincts run away with you. I need information, but do not stir up any hornets' nests getting it for me.
He looked pointedly at Silk.
I hope I have made myself clear about this. Don't complicate things just for the fun of it.
Oh, trust me, Belgarath, Silk replied with a bland smile.
Of course he trusts you, Keldar,
Velvet assured the little man. Belgarath looked at his impromptu spy network and shook his head.
Why do I get the feeling that I am going to regret this? He muttered.
I will keep an eye on them, Belgarath, Zadi promised.
Of course.
But who's going to keep an eye on you?
Chapter 7 That evening, they were escorted with some ceremony through the echoing halls of Zakath's palace to a banquet hall that appeared to be only slightly smaller than a parade ground. The hall was approached by way of a broad, curved stairway, lined on either side with branched candelabra and liveried trumpeteers. The stairway was obviously designed to facilitate grand entrances. Each new arrival was announced by a stirring fanfare and the booming voice of a gray-haired herald so thin that it almost appeared that a lifetime of shouting had worn him down to a shadow. Geryon and his friends waited in a small antechamber while the last of the local dignitaries were announced. The fussy chief of protocol, a small Malthusian with an elaborately trimmed brown beard, wanted them to line up in ascending order of rank, but the difficulties involved in assigning a precise rank to the members of this strange group baffled him. He struggled with it, manfully trying to decide if sorcerer outranked king or imperial princess, until Geryon solved his problem for him by leading Tsinedra out onto the landing at the top of the stairs.
"The royal majesties, King Belgarion and Queen Tsinedra of Riva,"
the herald declared grandly, and the trumpets blared. Geryon, dressed all in blue, and with his ivory-gowned queen on his arm, paused on the marble landing at the top of the stairs to allow the brightly clad throng below the time to gawk at him. The somewhat dramatic pause was not entirely his idea. Tsinedra had dug her fingernails into his arm with a grip of steel and hissed,
"Stand still!"
It appeared that Zakath also had some leaning toward the theatrical. Since the stunned silence which followed the herald's announcement clearly indicated that the emperor had given orders that the identity of his guests remain strictly confidential until this very moment, Geryon was honest enough with himself to admit that the startled buzz which ran through the crowd below was moderately gratifying. He began down the stairway, but found himself reined in like a restive horse.
"Do not run,"
Tsinedra commanded under her breath. "Run," he objected. "I'm barely moving."
"Do it slower, Geryon."
He discovered then that his wife had a truly amazing talent. She could speak without moving her lips. Her smile was gracious, though somewhat lofty, but a steady stream of low-voiced commands issued from that smile. The buzzing murmur that had filled the banquet hall when they had been announced died into a respectful silence when they reached the foot of the stair, and a vast wave of bows and curtsies rippled through the crowd as they moved along the carpeted promenade leading to the slightly elevated platform upon which sat the table reserved for the emperor and his special guests, domestic and foreign. Zakath himself, still in his customary white, but wearing a gold circlet artfully hammered into the form of a wreath woven of leaves as a concession to the formality of the occasion, rose from his seat and came to meet them, thereby avoiding that awkward moment when two men of equal rank meet in public.
"So good of you to come, my dear," he said, taking Tsinedra's hand and kissing it.
He sounded for all the world like a country squire or minor nobleman greeting friends from the neighborhood.
"So good of you to invite us,"
she replied with a whimsical smile.
"You are looking well, Geryon," the Malorian said, extending his hand and still speaking in that offhand and informal manner.
"Tolerable, Zakath," Geryon responded, taking his cue from his host. If Zakath wanted to play, Geryon felt that he should show him that he could play too.
"Would you care to join me at the table?" Zakath asked. "We can chat while we wait for the others to arrive."
"Of course," Geryon agreed, in a deliberately commonplace tone of voice. When they reached their chairs, however, his curiosity finally got the better of him.
"Why are we playing just plain folks?" he asked Zakath,
as he held Zinedra's chair for her. "This affair is a trifle formal for talking about the weather and asking after each other's health, wouldn't you say?"
"It is baffling, the nobility,"
Zakath replied with aplomb.
"Never do the expected, Geryon.